RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
We've discussed this already on Legal Hub, and that is Gary Judd KC's presentation to the Regulations Reviews Committee on Wednesday, October 16th, relating to why tikanga shouldn't be compulsory in legal education. And we thought we'd get Gary Judd KC on to talk directly about this. Gary, welcome to our Legal Hub feature. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I want to read this piece, and you've posted your oral submission on the Thoughts from the North Substack account of yours. And there's a video of your presentation as well on the Media Watch X account for those who are interested in maybe watching. Compulsory tikanga learning can't be disentangled from the attempts by certain sections of the judiciary to ramrod tikanga into our laws. They are aided and abetted by lawyers who have abandoned their commitment to the rule of law and are, along with many academics and allies in the public service, riding a bandwagon decked out in currently fashionable decolonization colours. It's tough talking, Gary, I'd say.
Well, in my view, it's perfectly justified by the circumstances.
Okay, so we've talked about tikanga becoming part of what would it be fair to say common law? Is that what it's morphing into, or there's an attempt to morph it into that here?
So we've got two things really. First of all, there are those who say that tikanga is part of New Zealand's common law. In fact, the day after I made my presentation to the Select Committee, I came across an address by the Solicitor General to a Maori Law Association conference, I think it was, back in 2018, which somewhat surprised me because back then, 3 years before the Council for Legal Education started working on these regulations to make tikanga compulsory for law students, the Solicitor General was recounting how Justice Joe Williams, one of the Supreme Court judges, had addressed her and other Crown Law Office lawyers, indicating that tikanga was part of the common law and they all had to get it and be on board with it. And the Solicitor General, who endorsed this and indicated that was certainly what the Crown Law Office was going to be doing. So back then, in 2018, it was being claimed that tikanga was part of the common law. And this, of course, is just plain nonsense because tikanga is not law at all. Tikanga as such is not law. Tikanga is a religious type social structure where reliance is placed on spooky supernatural stuff like rivers being our ancestors and the spirits of various gods being infused into rainwater falling from the sky and that sort of thing. In the statement of tikanga, which the Supreme Court later adopted when they delivered the decision in the Alice continuance proceeding, citing a statement of tikanga put together by the lawyers involved, that's the Crown lawyers, the Solicitor General once again, and the lawyers for Alice, along with a couple of or some Maori academics and joined by the Maori Law Society. The professors in this statement of tikanga indicated that tikanga was something which grew out of the land and some traditions, they said, when Maori came to New Zealand, tikanga was already here. So you can see from that that we're talking about a supernatural, spiritual type of thing, just like the same sort of approach that you might find with Christianity or any other form of religion. So the idea that this could be part of the common law plainly is just nonsense.
Yeah, Gary, these are smart people, aren't they? They know the difference between supernatural and everyday physical, don't they?
Well, I presume so. I mean, it's very difficult to understand the motivation for this sort of activity. But you're right, they are smart people. But what they are doing is pursuing a political agenda. Back in 2021, so that's 3 years after the Solicitor General's speech that I referred to a moment ago, back in 2021, a different Supreme Court judge gave a speech to, I think it was University of Waikato law students or students, in which he said that said something to the effect that once we complete the process of decolonization, then such and such. And so I asked the question in the rhetorically in my submission to the Regulation Review Committee, who are the we that this Supreme Court Justice was talking about? And plainly, she was part of the we, because that's what we means. She also instanced in that speech an article by a fellow Supreme Court Justice, Joe Williams, same one whom the Solicitor General was talking about 3 years earlier, as indicating or having written an article entitled Tikanga in Education, Can We Start With the Law Schools? So I think that's a pretty clear indication that Justice Joe Williams is part of the we. So what these judges are doing is promoting a political agenda, and a political agenda of so-called decolonisation. Now, what does that mean? Well, Justice Glazebrook gave us a clue in her speech, because in a footnote, she referred to an article written by a legal academic, if I recall correctly, in which this academic said that, taken at its most fundamental level, decolonization means the indigenous people taking back power and control. So this is what these people are on about, the indigenous people taking back power and control. Now, the important aspect of this is the taking power. It's the taking power and control. When you say taking back, you introduce, by using the term back, so a justification, a purported justification for taking power and control.
Hmm.
So what we're seeing here then is that through these legal mechanisms of inserting tikanga into the law, and through the legal education compulsory tikanga in legal education aspect, really seeking to inculcate law students with these notions. Now, don't get me wrong, it is possible for tikanga to spawn something which is legitimate in terms of law. The common law has long recognised that customs may be able to form part of the law if certain criteria are satisfied. So a custom is not something which sort of hangs around in the air. A custom is actually what people do. If they actually act in a certain way, and they do so consistently over a sufficiently lengthy period of time, that may mean that the people who are acting in this way have a custom. Now, just having a custom is not enough. The common law says that a custom may be recognised as part of the common law if it is general, that means, you know, it's not just confined to one or two people, but it's either general within a locality or it's general within a country as a whole. If it is consistent, if it is certain, if it has those characteristics, then it may perhaps attain the status of law, but it has to be, in addition to that, it has to be reasonable, and it has to be not contrary to morality, reasonable morality. Now, those are problems which tikanga, as a doctrine, as I've described it before, simply can't satisfy. But there may be things, the way people behaved back in the day, which could give rise to a custom. And interestingly enough, there's a good example of this, which involved Justice Clay's book, and it concerned an argument over the body of the partner of a Christchurch woman, and her husband, in fact, I think he was, for 20 years, and the father of her children, two or three children, he died in Christchurch, and she was the executrix of his will, and she wanted him to, in accordance with his wishes expressed before he died, to be buried in Christchurch where his family were, his children and his widow. But Tuhoe grabbed the body and took it back to the Bay of Plenty, and the executrix issued proceedings to get the body back. And one of the issues which, when it got to the Court of Appeal, one of the issues which had to be considered was whether Tuhoe had a custom which, in effect, allowed the tribe to take custody of a deceased member of the tribe. And what was done by initially the High Court and then reconsidered by the Court of Appeal was to consider what the evidence showed. And the evidence showed that Tuhoe did indeed have a custom of that sort. And it had the necessary characteristics of being general within Tuhoe, and it was consistent within Tuhoe. But despite that, the Court of Appeal did not recognise it as a custom which could satisfy the requirements for a custom to be recognised as part of the common law. And the reason that they did that is that they considered it was not reasonable. And the reason why they considered it was not reasonable is because it elevated the idea of might is right over the idea that rights trump the exercise of force. And so it is very ironical that that case was decided with Justice Clay's book giving the majority decision for herself and another Court of Appeal judge. That was decided in 2011. And then in 2022, I think, in the Ellis case, when Justice Clay's book came to consider tikanga more generally, instead of adopting the approach which she had correctly adopted in this 2011 case of saying, does this custom satisfy the requirements which enable it to be considered as law, she said tikanga cannot satisfy these requirements. So we are overruling these requirements. We are saying that because even though these requirements for recognising a custom have been developed over hundreds of years, that because tikanga could not satisfy the requirements, therefore the requirements were being rejected. And so PC really, what is in my view, a departure from the judge's obligation to decide cases according to the law, and elevating this mystical, supernatural tikanga system to a place where it actually was more important than the law. So what I was saying to the Select Committee is that if you that the only sound, only reason that there could be a basis for making tikanga compulsory for law students is if tikanga was part of the law. Now, of course, as the Supreme Court has effectively said that whether we like it or not, tikanga is part of the law, then that actually does provide a justification which the Council of Legal Education could put forward as the basis for saying, well, it's part of the law, therefore all students must know it, must need to know about it before they can practice law. But the point that I was making is that really the whole approach which allowed it to be argued that tikanga is part of the law is an approach which really can't be accepted in a free and democratic society, because essentially the Supreme Court judges were saying, we're going to make some new law here, we're going to say that tikanga is part of the law. Now, in New Zealand, Parliament is sovereign. Only Parliament may make and unmake law. Occasionally, when a court is deciding a case, and that, of course, is what courts are there for, to decide cases, that are not there to make pronouncements about what the law is or what, or to say that we're going to make law, or in the case of Alice, to unmake the law relating to the recognition of custom. When they decide a case where the case concerns something on the edges of the law, a new situation, it may be necessary for the existing law to be considered and perhaps extended, but pronouncing new law is not the job of the courts. And so I was saying to the Select Committee, really, this is a make or break situation. You have the opportunity by saying that, by asking Parliament to disallow these regulations, to effectively say to the courts, Parliament, are sovereign. We make the law. We decide whether the law should be unmade. That is not your job. And the Regulation Review Committee does have the power to move a notice of motion in the House of Representatives to disallow regulations of this sort, which are what we call secondary legislation. They're not made by Parliament. They're made by somebody else who is given authority to do it. In this case, the Council of Legal Education, which was given the power to make regulations concerning what subjects should be compulsory for law students. So I was saying that this is a watershed moment. The committee should decide that they will bring these regulations to the attention of the House, and that the committee or a member of the committee should move a resolution in the House to disallow the regulations. If they did that, they would be sending a message to the Council of Legal Education in the first place, but indirectly to the judiciary that Parliament is sovereign. If, on the other hand, the committee decided that they weren't going to do anything about this, then what their inaction could be seen as giving the green light to this sort of activism, which, as I said in my submission to the Select Committee, really goes far further than the legal activism, which from time to time and past during my legal career has been decried. It's going well beyond that, because this here is political activism, and it's indicated by the extrajudicial statements of the judges who are doing this.
It also potentially favours one group too, doesn't it?
Tikanga is plainly part of Maori spirituality. It's a Maori heritage. It's not the heritage of anyone else, although I suppose someone else could subscribe to it if they wanted to. So I'm not sure that I would say that in itself it's favouring one group. I suppose it's there is nothing wrong with anyone believing whatever they want to believe, so long as they do not seek to impose their beliefs on others. And that is what is wrong with this political movement. If it were simply saying we want those Maori who wish to subscribe to tikanga to be able to do so without interference from other New Zealanders, that would be fine. And that's something that I would support. But by trying to insert this dogma into the law as a whole, the attempt is being made to impose those matters of belief on the rest of the rest of New Zealand society.
Do you think the judiciary, members of the judiciary that you mentioned there, and the judiciary in general, believe this? Do you think they believe this?
They give every indication of doing so. Look, it's very difficult for a rational person to think that other rational persons could subscribe to spooky spiritualism. And so, I mean, the short answer is I really don't know. I cannot understand what motivates people to people who are intelligent in other aspects of their legal work. And they have indicated their intelligence. But in this aspect, it seems that they are willing to suspend belief, to suspend disbelief, and for some reason which is beyond me, to say that they are going to give credence to something which plainly no rational person would give credence to.
Just trying to think of how it would play out in a case. And I know cases are all different. But if you were to use tikanga in a defence, and I don't know what sort of case, but how could it be used? Could it mitigate against punishment or judgment in some way, or would be used in that way?
Well, there have been attempts in the past to use tikanga. I can't just bring to mind a specific example at the moment, but there have also been attempts by some Maori defendants in criminal cases to argue that the court does not have jurisdiction over them because Maori did not cede sovereignty to the Crown. And those sort of arguments have in the past been given short shrift. But as I say, I can't actually bring I'm having difficulty bringing an instance to mind. There have in fact been cases. I think there was one involving a truck driver somewhere down in the Bay of Plenty area who endeavoured to escape from the consequences of some bad driving or some road rage, I think, because he thought that his mother had been offended and therefore he was entitled to behave in the way in which he did. And I think actually in that case the court did give it some credence.
Yeah, I probably couldn't argue that though, could I, Gary? Me?
Oh, I shouldn't think so. Mm.
All right. So the New Zealand Council of Legal Education proposing that starting January 1st, 2025, that's not too far away, first-year law students must complete a course in tikanga Māori. Additionally, tikanga principles would be integrated into other compulsory subjects like contract, tort and property law. Not much time to run before this kicks off, Gary. You've made your submission, so things have to happen pretty quick now for that not to go ahead, right?
Yes, that's true. Although in this particular case, as I understand it, from my reading of the standing orders of Parliament, this can actually be dealt with quite simply. It's not like an Act of Parliament where it has to be introduced off to a select committee and then, you know, have three readings in the House, including committee stages. All that would be necessary here is for a member of the Regulation Review Committee to put down a notice of motion in the House asking that the House resolve to disallow the regulations, and presumably there would be a debate on that notice of motion, and if the people in favour, if there was a majority in favour of it, the regulations would be gone. And so it could be done in an afternoon.
Right, yeah. Probably wouldn't have been a chance of the previous government doing that, if there is a chance of this government doing that.
Yeah, well, there would be no chance of the previous government doing it, that's correct. I think there is a chance that this government might do it. The select committee, there were five members of the select committee, three National Party members and two Labor Party members. The Labor Party members included David Parker, who was actually the chair of the committee. So the first hurdle which has to be surpassed is for the committee to decide that a resolution should be moved in the House. So hopefully the committee has or will make such a decision, and if they do, then we just have to wait. We would have to wait until the resolution is put to the House. My expectation is that we won't know what the committee has decided until a resolution is put to the House, if in fact they decide to accept my submission. If they decide not to accept my submission, I presume they would tell me that. But at the moment, it's just a matter of waiting.
And what do we say as New Zealanders to our judiciary? Do we tell them just to stay in their lane? Is that what we tell them?
Yeah, well, I've been saying that actually for quite a long time now in various articles that I've written, because in our system of government, we have three branches of government. We have the executive, and that's cabinet and the government departments and other agencies of the Crown. We have the legislative branch, that's parliament, and we have the judiciary, the judicial branch. And the judicial branch, it is there to decide cases according to the law. And, as I've already explained, whilst in deciding a particular case, it may be necessary to extend the law because the facts are different to the existing law, it is not the job of the judiciary to be saying we are going to, it's not the job of the judiciary to make law, which is what they purported to do in the Alice case. That is to trench on Parliament's role, and this is really why I was saying to the Select Committee, you really have to take the step to start asserting the supremacy of Parliament, which, after all, is what the law says is required. It's there in black and white, most recently in the Senior Courts Act, which says that nothing in the Act is to detract from New Zealand's continuing commitment to the rule of law and the sovereignty of Parliament.
You've taken a few hits over this. I know Kylie Quince, who is, the Dean of the Law School, Auckland University of Technology. She was pretty, insulting towards you, which is a kind of an over-the-top reaction, isn't it, to someone who's you know, got what seems like to me, and I'm sure our listeners, a very solid position on this. Have you had any more like that yet, Gary? Are you expecting any more?
Well, I'm sure that if a member of the committee were to move a resolution in the House to disallow the regulations, then I expect there might be more in the House. But I haven't received Kylie Quince is the only one who has made those sort of comments, so far as I am aware. I mean, I actually spend most of my time working either for clients or on things like this, and I don't really bother too much about what people might be saying on social media or elsewhere.
Yeah, but it indicates a certain mindset, doesn't it?
Well, I think it indicates is a lack of preparedness to actually engage in reasoned debate. I mean, if Kylie Quince had said, I disagree with Gary Judd for this reason and that reason, that would be fine because if I wanted to, I could then say, well, actually, the reasons you have given don't stand up and we can have a debate about it. Resort to abuse of the sort that she resorted to, it really indicates to me that she was unable to confront the reasons that I have given for saying that dekanga is not part of the law. And it, to the extent that there are customs which dekanga has given rise to, well, they may be part of the law if they are proved to exist as a fact and if they satisfy the requirements which have been developed for recognition of customers law, which I spoke about before.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on, Gary, and explaining all that. Certainly takes us inside your thinking and inside the room, really. And if people want to watch your oral submission, as I mentioned, it's on the New Zealand Media Watch X site. And it's also, you've published your thoughts on your Voice from the North Substack, the oral submission, so people can have a read through of that. Thanks for coming on our Legal Hub, Gary. And let's, I guess we'll all sit here waiting for a result sometime soon. Either way.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.